Big Brian Tome.
John.
The man, myth, the legend.
None of those, actually.
Mr. Joe Rogan Jr.
Yeah, right. Oh, my gosh. Well, actually, we're going to talk about Joe Rogan today. Actually, we're going to talk about something that took place on his podcast. You up for this?
Yeah. It's great.
If you know anything about John Burke or me, you know that we're friends. John has been on three of the Aggressive Life episodes. He is the most listened to person by far on our podcast of all of our episodes. Not because at all of his total listens, you know, on the three podcasts, but just because the subject matter is so fascinating. And that subject matter is near-death experience. What happens when you die and are resuscitated? The heavenly visions people see, the light, the love that many of them feel. And for others who we've interacted with, the sense of a hellish experience. We're not going to go back into all of those things. It's unbelievable. Listen, I'm telling you, if you haven't heard John before in The Aggressive Life, go way back and listen to episode one. I've sent that to anybody who dies, anybody who knows somebody who dies, when they die, I don't send them that podcast. But when someone has someone close to them who dies and they're grieving, I always send that podcast. They say, oh gosh, thank you so much. It's not just for dying people though. It's just for all of us who may have a very successful life and yet we get sidetracked and forget that there is a massive play of eternity ahead of us. It's mesmerizing, incredible, faith lifting, or maybe for you, faith finding content. So I'm going to assume that you've listened to some of those to get the most out of this. Just stop this. This recording will be here for you this episode. Go back and listen to one of those. Start with number one and then come back here. So what we're going to do today, John, is we're going to go through some of the things that I hear about near-death experiences that I wonder what you say. And actually, before I even ask you that, how you doing, John Burke?
I'm good.
Yeah?
Yeah, how you been?
I'm very good. I am feeling very energized these days. I don't know what it is, but I feel really good. I don't know if it's because I had Kyle go into the lead pastor role in my day job Crossroads while I retained the senior pastor role. I don't know if it's that. I don't know if it's...
Yeah, I'm sure it is.
That's probably what it is. That's probably why I feel it's going to... So,
well, I'm glad. I'm excited for you, man. That's you've run a great run, you know, in that, and you didn't do anything stupid.
Well, I'm not done yet, John. Gosh, I haven't retired yet. I didn't even quit the pastor gig like you did.
You're a freaking quitter.
You just quit. But yeah, I didn't quit.
No, I'm just saying you've run a long good race, and
thank you.
And you're continuing to, but it is, you know, it is incredibly challenging. You see why when people go into hiding, they don't have ways to process it all. They do stupid things for escape.
Right.
So way to go. You didn't.
Well, thanks. I have a feeling it's going to be a very long podcast. It's going to be broke up into parts because I want to camp out here and talk about this before we get into the stuff that I told you we were going to talk about. Okay, because it's just good. It's fascinating to talk about this. Someone told me some time ago, I heard some teacher somewhere say, and I researched it, and I can't find anything to disagree with it, that when King David in the Bible, when he had his famous adulterous affair with Bathsheba, the same King David who killed Goliath, a wonderful start, and then he had a really, really tough end, and his end started when he had an adulterous affair, that he was 60 when he had that affair. Interesting.
I don't know.
When you piece it together, it actually makes sense that he was older like that. And the peers of yours and mine who have tapped out, DQ'd, I don't want to go through the most recent round of people that, you know, we know, they're older. And there almost is some thing where, hey man, get out while you're on top.
So, well, yeah, or you know, don't play Superman and like you're doing, give yourself some margin. Part of it is recognizing humanity, right? Our humanity, we have limits. And when we don't pay attention to those limits and you run at red line, and I don't care if you're a pastor or CEO or just whatever job you're working in, you run redlining for a long, long time. And usually you're doing that because there are tapes playing inside that say you must, you have to, you know, you should. It could even be what you're thinking is the voice of God. And in fact, you know, Jesus said, come to me, all you who are burdened and weary, and I'll give you rest. Come learn from me, you know, because I'm not a taskmaster. I'm gentle and I'm humble at heart, and you'll find rest for your souls. And I think when we don't pay attention to that, you know, then we end up doing stupid things for escape, you know. And I think there are way too many, not just in ministry, and all, I mean, all kinds of walks of life, yeah. Right?
Yeah, I think you're right. It could be an unsustainable life, and maybe somebody doesn't have the healthy rhythms, the healthy friendships, the healthy perspectives, attitudes, but maybe they can just white knuckle it and not do something really stupid morally for a while, but eventually, like, I can't handle it anymore. They do something, acts out. So I say all that to go, it's really cool that, you know, you finished the pastoral race in a very, very strong way. And now you've got another run that's in front of you. It's you manage your life well, and not just manage, but you make aggressive moves, which you've done, John. You've made aggressive moves, and it sets you up to have an only in class voice. It sets you up to do something that nobody else is able to do. And you're
which I think is what God is doing with all of us.
Yes, he is. Yes.
And
he
it
is.
Doesn't look the same, but the impact will one day be seen as the same, because you don't always see what God's doing under the surface, you know, through people.
Right. Well, God wants to do that through all people, but very, very few people are participating in that process with him and being diligent in how they lead their lives.
Yeah, because you're right. You have to be, what I would say is, aggressive in faith.
Yeah.
You've got to be willing to, you know, go all out trusting,
right,
when God is leading. And right. that is an aggressive posture toward God, as opposed to just toward what you think everybody wants you to do and be.
Yeah. You didn't need to make a move away from being a senior pastor of a church that's doing well and gives you a solid paycheck and gives you benefits and enables you to walk into parties and people want to hang out with John because he always seems to have interesting things to say. And there's a lot of little perks that come with being a senior pastor of a big church, you know?
And I've been feeling that lately.
Have you?
Well, you know, mainly because I'm starting a podcast and YouTube channel. I've just been dragging my feet for 3 years, and but I feel like the Lord wants me to do it, because I've got hundreds of hours of video interviews I've already recorded, but they're just sitting in my 12 terabyte hard drive, and nobody's right. Seen them. And you know, and so I decided to dive in and start, and oh my gosh, it's like starting over. And so, yeah, I've been thinking about that for sure.
Well, and the thing that you don't have now is you don't have a robust organizational structure around you to take some of your dreams and visions to life. You know, that's one of the perks of being a pastor.
Starting over.
Right. Yeah. I know. You don't. You know, I got dirt here. People say, how do you do the podcast? What do you do? Well, it's all that you got going on. You got books. You're speaking at these camps. You got how many times you're preaching. You've got the CEO duties. You got a podcast. How are you doing a podcast with all your stuff? Well, it's real simple. Four letter word: dirt. D-I-R-T. You know, Dirt works on all this stuff, and he shoves the notes right in front of my face, and he probably sends me one other email a week saying, how about these guests? What do you think about this? And, you know, it makes it happen. There's no way I could start a podcast on my own. Zero yeah. chance. And so that's what you're up against
feeling.
Right now.
That's exactly what I'm feeling.
Yeah. Yeah. Sucks to be you. Hey, heard everybody. Aside from two good friends catching up and talking shop, the reason John and I are want to spend the rest of our time today, which now I'm looking at Dirt, they got me wedged with a meeting coming up after this that I'm going to miss that or he's pushed back or
I don't know. I'll let them know.
Maybe you want to just text JPS, see what we're going to do here.
Let's get into it. We're riffing.
Yeah, we are. And I want to do that. It's part of, hey, as I say all the time, it's my podcast and I'll do what I want to. It's my podcast and I'll do what I want to. Do what I want to. You would do it too if you had your own podcast. It's all about me. But anyway, one of the podcasts that I listen to regularly, I wouldn't say regularly, is the Joe Rogan podcast. So I say regularly just because I don't really get excited about hearing comedians and him talk about getting high and stuff like that. It's fine for them to do that, but it doesn't kind of inspire me. But I really admire the man for having a level of curiosity that I think is very, very rare in America. I actually have great respect for a man who will say things not to upset people or to be a contrarian, just because saying things that he personally believes, and right when you want to pigeonhole him on one side of the political spectrum, he'll say something else on the other side. It's not to balance anything out. He's just a curious person who you can't put in a box. And I find him pretty interesting, and I find that he has some really interesting guests. One of the ones that I heard, I said, okay, I got to get John to talk about this, was Sebastian Junger, who has written some books, Restrepo, is one of the books, a lot of manhood books, looking at people who are dealing with coming back, dealing with PTSD or men in their wartime situation, how they've acclimated back to life. He's a really wise guy. So I thought, hey, man, gosh, Junger and Rogan on the same podcast would be fascinating. And Sebastian Junger had a near-death experience. So as I listened to it, because I have been a student of yours and I've picked up some other things along the way, I kind of understood how to frame these things. It wasn't a shock to my faith. It wasn't like a challenge to me at all, but it was just an interesting thing. I thought there's a lot of people who hear things about near-death experiences or hear other people's perspectives that maybe shouldn't be taken as gospel truth, or at least not the interpretation of their experience as gospel truth. So I thought we would do this. So I was going to play all the clips that was in this one with Joe Rogan, and we couldn't get approval. So I'm going to read you quotes that came from this podcast and get your reaction. Are you ready for that?
Yep. Let's do it.
All right, here we go. This is Sebastian Junger. And he says, and in case you don't know this, he has a near-death experience. The macro narrative, he has a near-death experience. He sees his father. He has a number of strange things that are happening, and he has a different interpretation for what took place. So I'll just read what he says, what he said, and then your thoughts. He says, I sensed below me this black pit open, like this infinite black void, and I was getting pulled into it, like all the darkness was contained in this hole. And I had the instincts of a wounded animal that if I go into the pit, I'm not coming out again. And I started to panic because I felt myself getting drawn in. And then my father, my dead father, appeared. He'd been dead 8 years. I love him, but I was not happy to see him. And he communicated to me, not with words, but basically the idea was, you don't have to fight it. You can come with me. I'll take care of you. It's okay. Don't be scared. I'll take care of you. And I was horrified. I was offended. I was like, you're dead. Why would I want to go with you? You're dead. You're the opposite of what I am. What do you think was happening with him?
Yeah. Pretty. I heard that because I agree with you. I listened to some of the Joe Rogan stuff. He's got some fascinating guests.
He does. Like only in class, really. I'll just give Joe Rogan props here. Like, talk about across the country. If you can get past some of the things that might offend you or whatever, understand, the guy is only in class, only in category. He's having 2.5-hour, 3-hour deep conversations with a lot of people who aren't getting – they're not giving sound bites. You actually can dig into things. And he's curious. He's really the only one that's out there doing it. He's first and only in class. So go ahead.
I personally, I think I think God is like going, hey, Joe, I'm here. Because he gets surprised by all these guests,
right,
who talk about, you know, either they had a near-death experience, they met God, they're, you know, they're believers, or like, you know, like this one. So when I heard Sebastian describing this in context, because I watched that episode, I was kind of like, oh my gosh, like this is the beginning of a classic hellish near-death right. experience. I mean, it's very common.
Right.
I've had people tell me, you know, as they were dying, it felt like they just, like their soul just fell through the bed, through the floor, and just starts dropping into this outer darkness, darker than dark, they would say, and a growing sense of hopelessness. Like, if I go here, I'm never getting out. Well, that's what he said, all those same things. And he was dying. And, you know,
you had 2000 interviews of this. I mean, you are the world authority on this. Nobody has talked with more people and consolidated data. Just for listeners, if you haven't listened to previous, you're the guy.
Probably closer to 1500, but 1500, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But I've studied it intensely for over 35 years. You know, and my whole thing is to look at not just what one person says, and we ought to get into that, because I'm still skeptical of what any one person says. But when you see the commonalities of what they say, you know, when 3, 4, 5, 10, 15 hundreds of people are saying the same basic thing, then you're like, okay, you know, what do you do with that? And, you know, I'm trying to show how it aligns with what scripture's been telling us about heaven, about hell, about the afterlife, and about God. And you know, and that's what I've been writing on. But I think this is, you know, the spooky weird part to me is his father showing up. But I have another, you know, another guy that I interviewed, Rajiv Partee, chief anesthesiologist at the Bakersfield Heart Hospital, and he was raised in India in Hinduism. He had gone down a road of just like he didn't care about his patients. I mean, what he said is, I'd become an addict to prescription drugs, an alcoholic, a materialist, abusive toward my son verbally, and his father was abusive toward him. So he didn't believe in near-death experiences at all. He had seen many people come back as a chief anesthesiologist talking about these things, and he would just give them a shot of antipsychotic drug. That's what he thought it was. And then he had one in the UCLA Medical Center. And it starts in a similar way in this hellish place, and it's far worse than what Sebastian talked about. And his father appears as he's crying out to God for forgiveness, because he realizes, and his father appears as well. And then he goes on and has this further experience where, I mean, it's like a Damascus Road experience, you know, where, you know, Acts 9, Paul encounters this brilliant God of light, just like near-death experiencers do. Who are you, Lord? He says, I'm Jesus. Well, he has this experience with this brilliant God of light, asks the same question, who are you, Lord? And Jesus steps out of the light. And so, you know, Rajiv then comes to believe in Jesus. Now, Sebastian, his near-death experience is pretty shallow, quite honestly. But his father there saying to him, hey, come with me, I'll take care of you. And he feels like this is not good, this is not right. You know, that could be several things, because I think, you know, from interviewing so many who've had hellish experiences, there's deception on the other side.
Yes.
And I think whoever this was, it might be his father, but it might also be
a demon taking on the likeness of his father.
And that can happen. I've seen it. I've heard stories of it. And so that's pretty like, wow. Okay. And he even said, this was not like a dream. This was not like a hallucination.
Right.
He said this was something else, very vivid, very real.
So we probably should just say here, if we're implying that he likely was on his way to hell, that sounds really horrible unless you understand a little bit about the Christian worldview that believes that Jesus teaches that everybody by nature is going to hell. Hell's a normal thing. And I'm not better than you if I have me go to me heaven and you're not, at least at this point. I'm not like some intrinsically better person who's smarter than you. I've just encountered the grace of God in a way that you haven't for whatever reason. And Jesus talks about wide is the path of destruction, narrow is the path to life. So when we hear someone like Sebastian Junger talking about this, it's not like us getting high and mighty saying, oh yeah, this guy, he's, you know, it's like, oh gosh, this is sad. This is what the masses will experience. And this is just an example of it. There's no judgment towards him. In fact, if he's hearing this, he wouldn't feel judged at all because he doesn't believe anything that I believe about Jesus in the afterlife. So you can't feel like you're being judged by someone who doesn't believe your stuff. But for those who may have a more of a spiritual bone in their body, this is really explained this way. This one's pretty simple, I think. Anything more you want to add to it?
Well, yeah, it's, I mean, it's very common. My friend, Paul Ojeda, who is a pastor today, but he had a cocaine overdose. And he said suddenly he was not high. He was more than sober and falling in this outer blackness. And Karina Martinez, who is from Colombia, who I interviewed, you know, she, when she dies, she's up above her husband's head and she realizes, oh my gosh, I'm dead. And she said, suddenly I realized all this is real. The afterlife is real. God is real. And she starts saying the Our Father. It was the only prayer she knew, you know, from growing up Catholic. But she said, but I meant it, you know, forgive me my sins, you know, and she knew all that. And she is headed into this dark darkness, head down, going down. Paul was just dropping like this. And they commonly say that there is a sense of hopelessness. Now, here's the thing, though, Brian, that I think is important, an addendum to what you just said, is that I have very much heard that from these people that God's desire is that nobody goes there and nobody has to go there. You know, Jesus talked about it. He talked about hell a lot. He talked about it as an outer darkness.
He talked about more than he talked about heaven.
Yeah, weeping and gnashing of teeth. And the reason is because he doesn't want anybody to go there. Now the thing I think that, you know, I love C.S. Lewis. I love what he says, and I've heard near-death experiencers confirm what he said, which is that the gates of hell are locked from the inside. In other words, hell is not God sending someone there because, you know, you flipped your nose up at me or you did this wrong and that wrong and that wrong. That's commonly the view people have. I think a better way to think about it is that God created us for a relationship with God. Like, that's why he created you, for a relationship, a love relationship. And love can't be bought. It can't be coerced, can't be forced. It has to be freely chosen. And that's where, you know, what you're saying, I totally agree with, that at some point in life, and this is the life we are in, where we live for a while with a taste of the knowledge of good and a little taste of heaven and God, but also hidden, and also a taste of evil and not God. And, you know, a war of wills where we're all trying to be God, you know, my will be done and you better do what I want. And God, you better do what I want, or I'm going to flip you off and go my own way. Well, so hell is the place where God, I think, finally, in great sadness, says, I've tried everything to draw you, to woo you, and you resist me, your will be done.
Yeah, and Sebastian Junger is very outspoken and actually pretty prideful that he's resisted God or the idea of God.
Well, so it's really...
He doesn't want God. He doesn't want God, so why would he... You could argue God would be doing Sebastian Junger a disservice by giving him heaven when he doesn't want God.
Well, I've often thought about that. Like, okay, so Earth is a place where God's will is not fully done. I mean, that's what Jesus taught us to pray. Your will be done on earth as it is in heaven, because it's not on earth, right? Not without willing creatures saying, okay, Lord, let me do your will. What would heaven be like if you have a bunch of people there who don't want God's will done? I want my will done. I still want to play God. Well, it wouldn't work, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if Hitler wants to still determine, you know, who lives, who dies, I want to play God. Does God chain him up in heaven?
Yeah.
You know, does he stop his will? Well, that's not freedom. That's not
right.
That's not love. So hell is the place where the light and the life and the love of God stays out.
Yeah. Well, he puts his own relationship with God or non-relationship with God. Just, I'll use his words himself. He says, so for me, believing in God is an active thing. And really, it's not that you found God. It's that God found you. And it's like when you fall in love, you can't choose to fall in love, right? I can't just decide to love God. That's not a feeling that you can summon and dictate to yourself. So I am an atheist because I don't make God a part of my daily practice. It's not part of my life, and I can't just choose to make it be. I could fake it, and I could go to church every Sunday, but I respect religion in its best form too much to friggin' fake it, right? For me, there's no evidence that there's a God. I mean, there's belief, and he goes on here, and... Yeah. So he said, no, I'm not on the God page. And I find this, this quote, and I'm just using this podcast because there's a lot of people who think this way. He's just articulating the way the masses think. He says, while I was dying, had God come to me, then I don't know, maybe I would believe it, but it just never happened to me. Wait, if God came to me, maybe I would believe it. So you're saying you are committed to never believing because you're not even saying if he came to you. Like, I'd be saying, if John Burke came and not, maybe I would believe there was a John Burke. What? That's delusional. Is there or not? So.
Well, and I think that points out something really important, which is that there is a ton of evidence, but we will see what we want to see.
Yes.
And if someone is committed to being, you know, here's the thing. We all create a worldview, right? We all create a system of how the world works and how I get ahead or how I get love and acceptance and all that. And it becomes what's called our noetic web. It's kind of like our system. And to challenge that is incredibly disruptive, offensive, scary. Most people don't. Most people won't challenge it, won't allow different points of view to challenge it, test it. And by the way, Brian, the you know this, but the strongest faith is not the faith that has never asked questions or doubted. It's the one that allows those questions and doubts and continues to press in to find as much resolve as you can, while also realizing there's mystery. There's some things we'll never know. But some people, the human ego can imprison us in our own construct. And, you know, one of the classics of that I interviewed was Howard Storm. you know, I think we've talked about him, but, you know, he was an atheist, tenured college professor, ends up in this hellish experience, right? Where nice people say, come with us. He doesn't even know he's dead, which is just another fascinating thing, is how many people don't know they're dead, because you step from life into more life.
Yes, right.
In this same outer darkness where he is just being mauled by these people, he hears in his soul, he said in his solar plex, pray to God.
Yeah.
And he said, my first thought is, I don't believe in God. And he hears again, pray to God. He's like, I don't pray. What would I pray? I'm not going to pray. I mean, he is literally having the worst experience of his life, and he's still fighting his own prison of ego.
Yeah.
But he finally does. You know, he finally does, and God rescues him. And, you know, because of that, he ends up coming back and leaving his tenured professorship to become a pastor.
Yeah.
I think the important thing, you know, like in Sebastian's case here, it's like, this is not determinant. Doesn't mean, hey, you're going to hell, buddy. So
yeah,
sorry. No.
But he does seem pretty determined. He's determined not to receive it.
If he holds that determinate anti, I'm God, I don't need you, and is not truly willing to seek God, then you're right.
Taking care of your health isn't always easy, but it should be at least simple. That's why for the last 2 years, I've been drinking AG1 every day, no exceptions, at home, on a hunting trip, camping off my motorcycle, no exceptions. It's just one scoop mixed in water once a day, every day, and it makes me feel ready to get moving. That's because each serving of AG1 delivers my daily dose of vitamins, minerals, pre and probiotics, and more. It's a powerful, healthy habit that's also powerfully simple. I like to have it in the morning. I have a 12 ounce of water, so right off the bat, I'm helping my hydration every single morning. This is the one product, if I had to recommend one, I'd recommend this one to elevate your health. It's AG1, and that's why I partnered with them for 2 years. So if you want to take ownership of your health, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free 1 year supply of vitamin D3 plus K2 and five free AG1 travel packs with your first purchase. Go to drinkag1.com/aggressivelife. That's drinkag1.com/aggressivelife. Get yourself some. I'll play Sebastian Junger. With your worldview, with your experiences, with your research, what would you say to him? He says this. He says, I'm reading the NDE stuff, near-death experience stuff, and the scaredy cat me finds it pretty convincing. Maybe there is an afterlife. How pleasant to think there's something, there's nothing to be scared of. And then I read afterwards the rationalists who call it, quote, nonsense. They say, we could explain all this. It's all neurochemistry. Like, there's no freaking afterlife. And so partly because the father I grew up with, who really valued rationalism, I decided, oh, well, nice try, close but no cigar. Oh, well, I guess when we're dead, we're dead.
Well, so, yeah, I think you're not taking into account all the actual evidential arguments that make me believe there is something going on that's real here and we should pay attention to it. In chapter two of Imagine the God of Heaven, I go after all these alternative explanations. The problem is the alternate theories might describe one aspect or another, but it doesn't explain these common elements that convince me. Well, let me run through them real quick, okay?
Yeah.
Number one, verifiable observations of their resuscitation. When people leave their body in a near-death experience, they say oftentimes they're up above watching their resuscitation. When they're revived, they're able to describe things that happened and went on and were said in the room. And there have been studies actually done to find they're 98% completely or mostly accurate, these observations. So that alone, and we can go more into it, but that alone for me grounds this experience in our reality. This is not hallucination. Now, some may say, well, maybe their ears are picking up on things, or, you know, even though, because they have no brain waves, and yet they're seeing and observing things.
Right.
Pam Reynolds had 100 decibel clickers in her ears in this deep surgery where they had to remove an aneurysm, deep brain aneurysm. And yet in the middle of it, she not only saw what the saw looked like that they opened her head up with, but heard the conversation, you know, between the doctors, is able to report all this. She had 100 decibel clickers in her ears. So saying that, well, you know, our senses are still picking up on things. No, that doesn't make sense. All right, so verifiable observations. Second, common elements. So near-death experiences are not all the same exactly. They're all unique, and yet they have this high percentage of overlap of common elements. So for instance, 48% of near-death experiencers see this God of light and love, all right? 32% have a life review. 57% see deceased family members. All right, but if it's just in the brain, if it's a human brain thing, why don't 100% see family members? Why would people from different religious cultures with no idea of God like that see the same God they're describing? Third reason, blind people, when they have a near-death experience, can see. And they report the same things as sighted people. That would make no sense if it's just in the brain.
Right.
How could they describe visual things when they had never had visual?
When their brain's never been able to do that. So now the brain can do it when you're dead?
Never done
that. Yeah, right.
Meeting unknown deceased people. So like this one woman I report on in Imagine the God of Heaven, she said on the other side, she sees this man there who didn't talk to her, but was just smiling at her very warmly. 10 years later, on her deathbed, her mom confesses to an extramarital affair and shows her a picture of her biological father. And she's like, oh my gosh, that's the man who was smiling at me in my near-death experience. Children who have a near-death experience meeting miscarried brothers and sisters that their parents had not even told them they'd had a miscarriage freaks the parents out. So that's four. Five is, you know, God. So, this is what I'm writing Imagine the God of Heaven about, is showing that 70 people I interviewed on, you know, every continent, every religious background are describing the same God. And this is the God who's been revealing himself throughout history, through the prophets. He's the God who said to Abraham and Sarah, I'm going to bless all nations through you. You know, this is 4,000 years ago. God said this before any world religion, sacred scripture was even written down. And, you know, so how do you account for that? If it's just brain-based, why is a Hindu man come back, and I have like seven of them in the book, saying this God was not like the Hindu gods that I knew? Why? That doesn't make any sense. All right, so a near-death experience, 75% say it was not a dream state at all. It was more real than this life. All right, well, that's not a dream state. That's not a hallucination. That's not what drugs do. So how do you account for more lucid? Seven, consistent. So near-death experiences are consistent with or without anesthesia. So you can't say it's anesthesia. Eight, knowledge beyond the body. So sometimes in this near-death experience, they travel like outside the room and see other things happening. Trisha Barker, someone I interviewed, she ends up, it was chaos in the room where they were trying to resuscitate her. She ends up floating out into the hallway and sees her stepdad at the candy machine buying a candy bar. And he was a health nut. He would never buy a candy bar. And so she was like, huh? And later confronts him on it. And he confessed, yeah, I went for the candy machine. And that's just one, you know, one off, but many examples like that. So that's 8, 9, memory retention. Okay, so think about this. You've got people like Dean Braxton with the hospital records, 1 hour and 45 minutes, no heartbeat. You know, medical doctors will tell you, you know, within less than a minute, you have a flat EEG with no heartbeat. You have no brain waves. Okay, so if this is all in the brain, where are these memories being stored if memories are just electrical impulses across the brain? That's how memories work.
Right, and there's no electricity up there.
There's no electrical activity. Mm-hmm. That's what an EEG monitors. And the last 10th point is life change. Dr. Pim van Lommel, who is a cardiologist in Holland, did a study across 10 hospitals in Holland of near-death experience patients. And he went back and interviewed them 2 years after the experience and then 8 years. And he had a lot of other data. But one of the things he was surprised with is how there was a spiritual change in the person who had a near-death experience compared to a cardiac arrest patient who did not have a near-death experience. And it was stronger after 8 years than after 2 years, consistently. Mm. So, you know, drug trips don't consistently change your life for the better, right? They don't make you a person who's less materialistic and more concerned about loving people and serving people. But near-death experiences do.
So how does someone who may be on the pit of hell, on the precipice of hell, and he comes out of it? What is it? Is it some people can will themselves to life, the perfect fantasy of humanism? You know, it's all about me and my effort. Is it God said, oh, I'm going to give you another shot here? Is it he was there, going there, but you know, his body and medicine just brought him back? Or, you know, what are we going to make of this?
Yeah, I don't fully know the answer to that, but I will tell you a couple things that are fascinating that kind of started to change my view. Is that I think there is a certain amount of will to live. That can influence. Now, I think when it's our time, and you're not gonna, you know, like God says, he knows the day is appointed, right? But I'm surprised with a lot of these near-death experiencers. You know, for instance, in Jesus' presence, sometimes he says, you got to go back. You haven't accomplished what you're supposed to accomplish. In other cases, he says, do you want to go back or do you want to come on with us to heaven? And so there's a freedom in that, which shocks some near-death experience and kind of shocked me too. I was like, really never really thought about that. But maybe there is, you know, at a certain point you have learned the things and accomplished the things and done the things. Can you do more? Is there more good? Yeah. And so maybe the Lord's like, I'll leave it up to you. There's another interesting thing that sometimes I've interviewed people who said, like, Jesus was having a conversation with the angels, like this one Australian professor. And he had had a massive heart attack, and he wants to go back. He wants to go back because he had young kids. His wife had left him, left the kids. He felt responsibility for them. Interesting. This is kind of a really cool aside. He's in this experience, and he's there with Jesus. He's with the angels, and he's just like overwhelmed with the love and the peace, the joy he's feeling. And then Jesus asks him if he wants to go back, and he starts thinking about his life back and his daughter and how how horrible it would be for her if he didn't go back. And he starts to get all this stressed out, anxious, panic feeling. And the angels freak out. They're like, whoa, wait, we're not used to that emotion here. That's not appropriate, you know? And basically calm him down and get him back into a state of peace and trust. And I just thought that was so fascinating.
Interesting. Angels rebuking people for being too emotional.
Well, no, for being worried and stressed out.
Yeah, yeah. That's what I mean. Yeah, people would not want to say they're worried and stressed out. They would just want to say they're emotional.
Yeah.
No, you're worried and stressed out.
But Jesus said to them, go check the vessel. Go check the vessel. And he watches them float down to the ambulance and come back and go, it's okay. Hmm. Meaning the vessel, the body, is okay to still house the soul, the spirit. Which is weird. I still haven't, there are a lot of things, crazy. Brian, that I'm, you know, I still have like all these data points and I'm trying to connect them all up. And
wait, you don't know all truth, John? John Burke doesn't know all truth? You don't, you're
all,
not 100%?
All but 2%.
Yeah, the 2% is what your wife wants you to know. That's what you don't know.
I know, the truth is.
That's a good line. That's a good line right there.
Keep that. There is so much mystery, but there's a lot we can know. You know, I totally disagree with Sebastian Junger about there's just no evidence.
Yeah.
There's no proof. That's not true. There is so much evidence. But I've also watched people, you know, do everything they can instead of to really grapple with the evidence one by one to push each point of evidence away.
Yeah.
And if you want to play that game, you can. I think the best question to ask is, am I sincerely wanting to know? Like, am I sincerely seeking God? Like, if there is a God, I really am sincerely willing to let God be God. Yeah. And I'll step down from playing God and I'll follow him. And if your answer is, you know, no, no matter how much evidence there is, I don't want to do that. Well, then there you have your answer. There's not
word.
Enough evidence.
It's one thing to be sincere. It's another thing to sincerely want to know God. Those are two entirely different things.
And, you know, that's what God says, you know, in Jeremiah, if you seek me with all your heart, you will find me. You know, and I've seen that. I've seen that with these near-death experiencers, you know, who it's so fascinating, Brian, because sometimes, you know, what I find is, and this used to throw me off, honestly, like there are a lot of things that took me a long time to write Imagine Heaven because I was kind of like, I don't get that. Like, if these people are standing before Jesus, why didn't Jesus just tell them, believe in me, I'm Jesus, you know, here's the gospel, go do this. And I didn't understand why didn't he do that, you know? And then I had the aha, like, as if he couldn't do that now if he wanted to, you know? And when Paul was in the presence of the same God of light and he asked, who are you? He told him he's Jesus, but he didn't tell him the gospel. He didn't tell him, you know, you got to believe in me. He didn't tell him what to do.
Interesting.
He later sends Ananias to explain it. And then Paul still had a choice, right? He was a very powerful, wealthy Pharisee. He had a lot to lose. And so he had to decide, will I get baptized in the name of Jesus and become a follower of Jesus? I'm going to lose my life.
Yeah, that's a great twist I haven't really thought about before. You're right. It comes back to this faith thing.
And that's what God wants.
Yeah, right.
He wants trust. And I believe... Yeah. I believe the reason, you know, faith, you know, it says without Hebrews 11:6, without faith, it's impossible to please God. And I used to ponder that, like, why? Why is that the most important thing to you? You know, I thought of faith as this nebulous, like, well, I just have to muster up. It's kind of like what Sebastian Junger is. Well, I have to muster up some feeling, right? That's what he's saying. Like, I don't feel love for God. I can't make it up. I respect religion too much to fake it.
Right, right. Yeah.
Well, that's not faith. Faith is trust. And trust is the bedrock of any relationship. You know, trust means you start to try to get to know the other person. You let yourself be known. You put your trust in what you're learning and know about that person more and more to move closer to them in action. Right?
Yeah, right.
I mean, that's how any relationship is developed. So it's not you have to have some feeling of love, like Sebastian Younger says. What you have to have is a desire to go, okay, God, if you really are there, I'm going to go all out open-minded. And so many people talk about, you got to be open-minded. But if they really check themselves, are you really open-minded to God having revealed himself in history through Jesus? Because I'm telling you, if you're open-minded and you seek, you're going to find amazing evidence, historical evidence. I mean, I put it in the book, Imagine the God of Heaven. It's right there. But you're also going to find near-death experience evidence. You're also going to find people all over the place who have had very real experiences of God. Not always as we want to say, well, if you're real God, then I want to hear an audible voice and tell me to do that. And he doesn't really respond to that.
Right.
He responds to a true, open, seeking heart.
John, what's the best one-stop shop for somebody to follow up with you or get all of your materials or thoughts, all that stuff?
Probably imagineheaven.net. And I'm going to be launching a podcast, hopefully, a few months from now. It'll all be out there, but books are out there too. And how to email us if you want.
Imagineheaven.net. So what do I got to do to get on your podcast? Do I got to die? Is that how I get on your podcast? I have to die? Like, you're not just going to have your old buddy, Brian.
No, that's not good.
I have to die.
That's not good enough, Brian. Right?
I have to die, and I've got to come back to life. Great.
Exactly.
Oh, geesh. See, I don't put these restrictions on you, John. I just, you're a friend. I have you on. You get to pump your books, do all that stuff. I don't do that with you, but no, sorry. I got to die in order to come pump my product with you. That's real Christian of you, John.
High bar.
Hey, John, thanks for coming on The Aggressive Life again. Everybody, this is really good. I don't know what you want to do coming out of this. We say all the time this is not the Interesting Thoughts podcast, but there is a lot of interesting thoughts here. And if you get your mind on eternity and the God who loves you, your life is going to change. You're going to go someplace, and you're going to be facilitated to take aggressive moves. So check out imagineheaven.net, and we'll see you next time on The Aggressive Life.
Thanks, man.
Thanks for joining us on this journey toward aggressive living. Find more resources, articles, past episodes, and live events over at briantome.com. My new books, a repackaged edition of The 5 Marks of a Man, and a brand new 5 Marks of a Man tactical guide are open right now on Amazon. If you haven't yet, leave this podcast a rating and review. It really helps get the show in front of new listeners. And if you want to connect, find me on Instagram at Brian Tome. The Aggressive Life is a production of Crossroads Church, Cincinnati, Ohio.